Hari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Giridhar Dhari. Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Giridhar Dhari. Yashoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Giridhar Dhari. Yashoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Shri Shri Radha Madhav ki, Shri Shri Radha Kunja Bihari ki, Shri Kishore Kishore ji ki jai, Gaur Premanandi. Hare Krishna. Being in Chicago and singing Jai Radha Madhav, I can't not think of His Holiness Rama Padmaraj, who has the most ecstatic Jai Radha Madhav that I can think of in the movement. He sings it favorite for me. So we're reading 10th canto, 13th chapter, texts 32, 33, and 34. Chapter's entitled Brahma Stealing the Boys and Calves. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayanam Namaskritya Narum Chaiva Narottamam Devim Saraswatim Vyasam Tato Jayam Udirayet Nasta Prayastu Badreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya. Bhagavati Uttama Shloke Bhaktir Bhavati Naishtaki. So we have here. Okay, so we have text 30, two here, so we'll chant that together, and then I'll read the other two as well. Gopa, the cowherd men, Tat Rodhana Ayasa. Of their attempt to stop the cows from going to their calves. Mogya, on account of the frustration. Laja, being ashamed. Umanuna, and at the same time becoming very angry. Durga Adva Krichchataha. Although they passed the very rough way with great difficulty. Abhyetya. After reaching there. Govatsai. Along with the calves. Dadrishu. Saw. Sutan. Their respective sons. Gopastadrodanasya sa Mogya Rajarumanyuna Durgadva Kritrato Bhetya Govatse Dadrishu Sutan. Gopastad Rodhanayasya Mogya Lajorumanyuna Durgadva Kritrato Bhetya Govatse Dadrishu Sutan. Please chant. Gopastadhodanayasya Mogya Rajarumanyuna Durghadva Kritrato Bhetya Govatse Vidjushu Sutan. Gopastadhodanayasya Mogya Rajarumanyuna Durgadva Kritrato Bhetya Govatse Dadrishu Sutan. Gopastadhodanayasya. Mogya Rajarumanyuna Durgadva Kritrato Bhetya Govatse Dadrishu Sutan. Translation and purport by His Divine Loving Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Jai Prabhupada. The cowherd men, having been unable to check the cows from going to their calves, felt simultaneously ashamed and angry. They crossed the rough road with great difficulty, but when they came down and saw their own sons, they were overwhelmed by great affection. Purport: Everyone was increasing in affection for Krishna. When the cowherd men, coming down from the hill, saw their own sons, who were no one else than Krishna, their affection increased. We'll read two more texts, 33 and 34. I'll chant the Sanskrit, make the attempt. Tad iksanu prema rasa plutasaya jatanuraga gata manyava rebakan udhyadvibhi pari bhaya mudhani grinher avapu paramham mudham te. At that time, all the thoughts of the cowherd men merged in the mellow of parental love, which was aroused by the sight of their sons. Experiencing a great attraction, their anger completely disappearing, they lifted their sons, embraced them in their arms, and enjoyed the highest pleasure by smelling their sons' heads. Classic sign of affection between father and son. After Brahma stole the original cowherd boys and calves, Krishna expanded himself to become the boys and calves again. Therefore, because the boys were actually Krishna's expansions, the cowherd men were especially attracted to them. At first, the cowherd men who were on top of the hill were angry, but because of Krishna, the boys were extremely attractive, and therefore the cowherd men immediately came down from the hill with special affection. Tatha pravaya so gopas tokashlesa sunivritaha kritshrakchanir apago apagatas tad anusmitri udasravaha. Thereafter, the elderly cowherd men, having obtained great feeling from embracing their sons, gradually and with great difficulty and reluctance, ceased embracing them and returned to the forest. But as the men remembered their sons, tears began to roll down from their eyes. Purport. In the beginning, the cowherd men were angry that the cows were being attracted by the calves. But when the men came down from the hill, they themselves were attracted by their sons, and therefore the men embraced them. To embrace one's son and smell his head are symptoms of affection. I'll read all the texts together one more time. Beginning with text 32. The cowherd men, having been unable to check the cows from going to their calves, felt simultaneously ashamed and angry. They crossed the rough road with great difficulty, but when they came down and saw their own sons, they were overwhelmed by great affection. At that time, all the thoughts of the cowherd men merged in the mellow of paternal love, which was aroused by the sight of their sons. Experiencing a great attraction, their anger completely disappearing, they lifted their sons, embraced them in their arms, and enjoyed the highest pleasure by smelling their sons' heads. Thereafter, the elderly cowherd men, having obtained great feeling from embracing their sons, gradually and with great difficulty and reluctance ceased embracing them and returned to the forest. But as the men remembered their sons, tears began to roll down from their eyes. Omagyan Tarandasya Ginanjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Nama Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishtaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatyadesha Tarine Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya, Prabhu Nityananda, Shri Advaita Gadadhar, Srivas Adi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. So it feels very awkward to be sitting here in front of you all, some of my devotional heroes and some of my good friends, so I don't really belong sitting up, but what to do? I'll be happy to have a discussion with you all, but I'll maybe lay out a few points first to get the discussion rolling. There were two directions that I wanted to take the discussion based on the prompting of the text and Prabhupada's purports. One is this the nature of anger and how easily and quickly it comes, and why it comes also. I wanted to discuss a little bit about that. And then also, a little bit more of an exciting discussion is that the devotees are crazy, and that this little incident here indicates that we should embrace the craziness that comes in Krishna consciousness. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, there's a phrasing that comes often, prema unmadha. Does anyone know this? Prema unmadha? Yeah, divine madness of ecstatic love. And this is actually our goal. The material world around us, especially Josh and I were discussing this yesterday, people are getting crazier and crazier, and it's being documented that mental illness on every level, from depression to schizophrenia, et cetera, is just increasing tenfold. And people are trying to figure out how to mitigate this situation and how to bring people back to a sane condition of life where they feel some sense of healthy self and don't feel all this mental instability. the irony is that as Krishna conscious practitioners, we're trying to create a sort of insane condition in our consciousness, which is not only experienced but also ecstatic or ever increasing. We actually want to go crazy forever and never stop going crazy. We want to go a little crazier moment to moment, day to day, week to week, month to month. We want to become a little crazier. Prema unmadha. So in this particular pastime here, we see that the cows are doing something a little crazy. What are the cows doing that's crazy? Yeah, they're abandoning the babies, right? Who really need their milk. Their babies can't eat anything but mom's milk, and moms love when babies need them, right? That's the whole rasa of mom and child, is that this living entity is totally dependent on me, and I'm totally happy to offer all of myself to this child, and that's most there. In fact, vatsalya ras, right, is the parental exchange of love between Krishna and his devotees, and that word, vatsa, is particularly referencing the calf, because the calf is such an endearing little thing, such a cute, cuddly, adorable entity, and mom loves to take care of her calf, especially the young one. So it's a little crazy that moms, all these moms, not just one or two, but the whole herd of moms, are abandoning their baby calves and charging down the hill to go see their older calves who don't even actually drink milk anymore. And why are they doing that? Why are they doing this crazy thing which is so outside of the natural law, the natural way of being? Yeah, by going to feed those calves, they're going to get to feed Krishna directly. Even though they don't realize that, their sixth sense, their sense of Krishna prema, that spontaneous attraction that devotees feel towards things which are favorable for their devotional service, that's pulling them down the hill, away from who they should be taking care of, away from who they should be worried about, and towards the older calves who ostensibly have been eating grass and fruits and other things in the Vrindavan forest for long enough that they don't need mom's milk anymore. But then the calves also do something crazy. They accept mom's milk. Why? Because they're actually Krishna. And Krishna knows what he's doing. He's setting up this whole scenario, as I'm sure has been discussed in many of the other classes already. This whole scenario is actually not because Lord Brahma's a knucklehead and he stole the calves and etc., etc. He's just an instrument of Krishna's desire to reciprocate with his devotees in these unique ways. So the devotees are a little bit crazy, and they do things a little off sometimes. Things that don't exactly seem to fit with what a normal course of life, a healthy approach to things might be. And yet, because of that craziness, they're able to attract Krishna. I was thinking about our own Srila Prabhupada. Had everyone seen the new Hare Krishna film, the mantra, the movie, the man that started it all? Srimati Maharaj's quote in that film is very memorable. Old man, you are crazy, you will die. Srimati Maharaj, of course, is the owner of the Scindia Steamship Company, the owner of the Jaladuta ship, which Prabhupada crossed the Atlantic on. And in the movie, she says very firmly and crazy, old man, you will die. That's what I was thinking. He's crazy. 70 years old. What will you do? You never even left India. And you're going to go to America with nobody that you know, no money, no contact, practically speaking, just some possibility of a contact, some possibility of an acquaintance when you get there. What are you going to do except die in the streets alone? So far away from Vrindavan Dham and your beloved Radha Damodar. What are you going to do? But what did he do? Something crazy. That forced Krishna to reciprocate in so many other crazy ways. When the pure devotee extends themselves, then it impels Krishna to act in crazy ways, to reciprocate with that bravery of love, that bravery of bhakti that the devotee is indicating. And it's it's wonderful to discuss Srila Prabhupada, and another devotee I wanted to discuss in his crazy tendencies was Srivas Thakur, because today is Srivas Thakur's appearance day. Srivas Thakur is famously crazy. Even Lord Chaitanya pointed this out. In a conversation with Srivas one day, Lord Chaitanya came to his home and said, "Hey Srivas, by the way, how do you pay for any of this?" Every day, for the last few years, you've been doing nothing but hosting the devotees and having kirtan at your home. I've never seen you work. I've never seen you go to the market. I've never seen you make any extraneous endeavor to try to create a safe, stable situation for your family. What gives, Srivas? How do you manage that? And Srivas says, "Well, I just depend on the mercy of Krishna." And Mahaprabhu replies, "Well, what if the mercy of Krishna doesn't come? What if one day your family has no food?" And what's Srivas' reply? "Oh, we'll just fast that day, no problem, no big deal." And Lord Chaitanya, "Well, what about if for 2 days the Lord's mercy doesn't come and your family has no food? What's his solution to that?" "Well, fast a little more, fast one more day." "Okay, well, how about on a 3rd day? If the Lord's mercy hasn't come and you still have no food and you have no water and your family is crying and their stomachs are shrinking and the children are screaming, what are you going to do then?" "Well, at that point we'll understand that the Lord no longer wants us around and we'll happily take ourselves to the Ganga and Ganga Mai Ki Jai, drown ourselves." Now this sounds crazy, this sounds irresponsible. If you ever heard somebody speaking like this in the normal course of life, you'd call the Department of Social Services, you'd say, "Excuse me, ma'am, I think we have a problem. I'd like to report an abusive parent at this address. You need to send some officials down right now. You need to get these children out of that dangerous situation." But instead, this idea of Srivas was very pleasing to Lord Chaitanya. He was very impressed by that. He was very happy. Later on, Srivas actually had an opportunity to kind of demonstrate the intensity of that renunciation that he has towards his family and external circumstance. What was that situation that came up in Srivas' family life that allowed him to actually demonstrate the intensity of this renunciation that he was speaking about with Mahaprabhu? Yeah, his son died. His son died in his house while he was there. And what was Srivas' approach to the passing away of his son? Srivas was trying to get his wife and the other ladies of the house to keep things quiet, not cry, not make a disturbance, because if there was a disturbance, if Mahaprabhu saw that Srivas' wife was sad and upset, then it would disturb Mahaprabhu's mood in the kirtan. It wouldn't allow Mahaprabhu to enjoy the Premanam Sankirtan that Srivas had so much relished creating an environment to take place for the past few years. And then when Mahaprabhu found out that Srivas' son had passed away, what happened? Yeah, then he revived him, right? And then Srivas' son got to preach a little Bhagavatam before going back home, back to Godhead. So this is crazy, isn't it? Your son dies in your house, and instead of running to the bedside and holding your wife's hand and sobbing uncontrollably at the loss of your child, you're trying to get everybody to keep quiet so that the kirtan can keep going. So we can just keep playing the music, right? Don't stop the show. It's crazy. But it actually attracts the Lord so much and compels the Lord to do incredible, wonderful things, like revive your dead son, because it's no big deal for him. how many hours, how many days, how many weeks, how many months, how many years might parents have been praying when the unspeakable loss of having your child pass away before you occurs? How long they might spend appealing to the Lord that somehow or other he bring their child back, right? We can imagine. Many, many parents over the all course of time who have ever had this tragedy happen to them, they would spend a lot of time appealing to the Lord in some way like that. And yet Srivas didn't make a peep. He didn't even even consider or think or even feel that he would want his son to come back in that way, or ever think to bother Krishna with that request like that. And yet, almost immediately, Lord Chaitanya revived his son. So when the devotee acts in these kind of crazy ways, it compels the Lord to reciprocate in these crazy ways, and it accentuates the loving exchange that the two are having with one another. And then one final notable pastime of Srivas, which is a nice segue into the discussion about anger and how it comes up so easily for people like myself anyway, but not so easily for devotees absorbed in genuine Krishna consciousness, is the day that Srivas walked out of his front door and saw placed before him pots of liquor and animal bones and blood and the other unsavory paraphernalia of needed to perform Kali Puja, worship of Durga Devi. And Srivas Thakur walked out of his front door and he saw, literally he was framed, somebody had adorned his door as though he'd been doing Kali Puja. He was framed, or made to look as though he was, with his door frame, performing Kali Puja. And what was Srivas' reaction to that when he came out of his front door and saw that somebody was trying to make him look like a mundane, materialistic Kali worshipper? Finally. Everyone come, please, please gather around. He called, not only did he accept the accusation, or the implication, we could say, of the paraphernalia, not only did he accept that, yes, this is evidence that I myself am nothing but a mundane Kali worshipper, but he actually called other people. He wanted other people in the village to come and see that actually I've just been putting on a show of being a Krishna Bhakta, but really this is my heart. This is my real situation, is that I'm just a mundane materialist worshipping Devi to try to get name, fame, profit, adoration, and distinction. If I look at my... Now, this is the craziest thing. In my estimation, this is the craziest thing that Srivas has done. Because, generally speaking, and I, specifically for myself, if anybody ever criticizes or tries to address my position and make it sound or seem as though it's not very exalted like I think myself to be, then immediately all kinds of anger and frustration and... other unsavory emotions just erupt from me. I've gotten a little better at not allowing others to see that eruption, but on the inside, there's a volcano exploding that this person dares to challenge my position, my prominence, my power, my prestige. How dare they? And so it's literally unconscionable for me to think that Srivas could, with genuine feeling, see that attempt by this person. What was the guy's name? Gopal Chappal? Gopal or something? Gopal Chappal? I think it was. Wasn't it Gopal Chappal? And then he gets leprosy and then Mahaprabhu. Okay. Potentially. No. Yeah, he was a knucklehead. But it wasn't him. Does anyone remember the name of this person that offended Srivas this way? Gopal Chappal? I think so too, but I'm not 100% on that. So when Gopal Chappal, will say, offended Srivas in this way, Srivas genuinely felt that, yes, I deserve it. This is my situation. What to speak of denying it or just kind of ignoring it, or we might say tolerate. Srivas actually genuinely felt that this was the truth. And this is a crazy level of humility which can only be experienced or expressed when someone is experiencing simultaneously Krishna Prema. In the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, Sanatana Goswami gives a really beautiful description between the relationship of Dainya, humility, and Prema. And he basically describes them as synonymous, or two sides of the same coin. Genuine humility is Prema, and genuine Prema is humility. And Srivas's behavior in that particular pastime expresses that to the nth degree, to a level that my material mind is not able to even conceive of as possibly genuine, and yet there it is happening because of the strength of the love of that devotee for the Lord. So, anger. We are reading here that the cowherd men, the cows had given birth to new cows, the cowherd men, having been unable to check the cows from going to their calves, felt simultaneously ashamed and angry. It is a very interesting juxtaposition. The cowherd men felt ashamed. And shame is a feeling that is normally directed towards who? Yeah, we feel shame for ourselves. And then simultaneously they felt anger. This is reminiscent of Srila Prabhupada saying in the fourth canto that anger is the younger brother of lust. Meaning that anger is never the primary emotion. Right? The younger brother, the younger brothers always do what? They always follow their older brother. Right? That's the characteristic of the younger brother. He doesn't do anything for himself. He's only watching what everyone else is doing and following. That's what younger brothers do. So Srila Prabhupada characterizes anger as the younger brother of lust. Meaning that anytime there's this feeling, this emotion of anger, underneath that expression of anger is another emotion. And in the case of the cowherd men right now, that emotion is shame. They're feeling what? They're feeling disappointed in themselves as cowherds, that they're not able to properly perform their duty. This is so outside of, this is so adharmic, practically. This is so outside of the natural course of things that our cows are allowing their grown calves to feed rather than their young calves who are completely dependent on them suckling. And so the cowherd men felt ashamed, but then that emotion of, and because these devotees are on a pure platform, we can't take it to that level for them, but I'm in discussion of our own situation. When we feel anger, imagine if we were in this particular circumstance and we felt this shame, and then anger rises from that. Naturally, that anger is something that we try to project onto someone or something else. So just running through a mental exercise myself through this, I was thinking, if I was in that situation and I was embarrassed, I was ashamed that my cows are behaving in this awkward way, then the first thing I would do is probably blame my son. My anger would be towards my son. I'd probably say something to the effect of, why did you let your calves come over here? You know that we're over here and this will distract the mothers, and now you've let this happen and look what you've done. You've created a totally topsy-turvy situation. How dare you graze your calves over here when you know that we're over here on Govardhan Hill grazing the cows and the younger calves. Right? I might get angry in that way. And I might feel justified. And that's the little kid and I'm the big adult and he's made this mistake and it's certainly not my fault. That's the nature of anger, is that the real emotion, the real frustration is with ourselves. There's this feeling of shame, there's this feeling of embarrassment, there's this feeling of inadequacy, there's this feeling of fear. There's some feeling inside which is making us intensely insecure. And so rather than facing our own insecurity, we flip it around and try to blame the shortcoming on someone outside of us. Some circumstance outside of it. It's not my fault. It's its fault. Your fault. Their fault. And this is the mundane expression of anger. So I was thinking about a few instances in my own Krishna consciousness where I had this this welling up of anger, and then later on Krishna adjusted me and showed me the real situation. One funny one that I was remembering just this morning, so I'll share that briefly. And then I wanted to, while I'm sharing, I'm prompting also that I want you guys to have some examples of crazy devotees in your own life, or also circumstances where you or another person that you're close with indulged in this feeling of anger, and then later on you were adjusted. You saw the real situation. Because the cowherd men are getting angry, but actually the real situation is that Krishna is making some special arrangement. And that's the irony of any time we actually get angry, is that we're ultimately angry, disappointed, frustrated at Krishna. not at anybody else, not at our son, not at our father, not our temple president, not our GBC, not our guru, not our friend, not our bhakta. Any of those feelings of frustration that we project onto someone else ultimately come back to a feeling of frustration with Krishna, some disconnect in our relationship with him. And so I've experienced myself that many times when I indulge in this feeling of anger, eventually, and sometimes immediately, Krishna shows me that actually I'm doing something here, and who are you to get so upset? Who are you to think that you can do things better than I've arranged them? I have a much bigger plan going on than what your tiny brain can conceive of, and please take a step back and let it happen so that everyone can be happy and not just you. So one particular funny little instance of this was a close friend of mine, Vanna, who used to live in the Harmony Collective, used to live in our center. She wasn't coming out of her room all day. And this used to be a problem where she would kind of like shut herself away for a day or two and not talk to anybody and not do anything. And we'd had many conversations about how it's important not to behave like that in an ashram. And if you need a personal day, then you just kind of communicate that, let somebody know so that that accountability is there and nobody has to wonder, hey, what's Vanna doing? And all of you devotees know you've lived in ashram circumstances before. So it's not healthy or helpful to have somebody kind of like check out without checking in first and letting folks know that's what's going on. So Vanna hadn't done that for a really long time. And then suddenly there was this particular day, there was a lot going on. There was a lot that we were trying to do. There was a kind of a Harinam program and a few things. And she wasn't coming out of the room. She wasn't saying anything. She was nowhere to be seen or found. And I was getting angry. I was feeling, what's this girl doing? We got stuff to do. We got places to go. We got things to be able to execute. But something stopped me from banging on the door and saying, Vanna, come out here, and what are you doing, and why haven't you done this yet, and why haven't you done that yet, and don't you know that we have to be here? Something stopped me, something held my tongue. Krishna, super soul in the heart, protected me on this one. Something stopped me from my natural reaction at this situation, which is anger at Vanna not communicating this to me. And then come to find out later on, the devotees surprised me. My birthday was 2 days later. But the devotees surprised me with a spontaneous Harinam that evening. They tricked me to go to U of M campus because I was supposed to meet somebody. And then while I was walking to go meet this person, they like erupted out of this building with this awesome Harinam. And it was literally the sweetest birthday gift I've ever received, because I'd always felt a little sad that I never saw the devotees on the street before I got Srila Prabhupada's book and began reading and becoming favorable. I always kind of wished that I had spontaneously happened on a Harinam, but it hadn't happened, and so I had this little desire in my heart, and they fulfilled it in this amazing way on my birthday, when I was, you know, totally out of it, walking to go see this person that I thought I was meeting, and then they erupt out of the building with this awesome Harinam. Somehow this group of students, just like, you know, Krishna's arrangement again, also simultaneously joined, and there's like 10 students and 20 devotees, and we all just in this huge fervor. And then somebody comes up to me with a garland that literally is the size of my shoulder, like all the way around, like 10 feet. And it's, my forearm is too small to show you the size of this garland. I'm too puny. It's like double my bicep was the size of this garland. And that's what Vanna had been doing all day, was making me this obnoxious garland, which was totally embarrassing. And I took it off as soon as she put it on me. But it was a very sweet thing for her to do. That's her service. She's like an incredible garland maker. And so that was her gift to me on my birthday. That was her offering of love. And my whole day I'd spent angry at her for this act of kindness, this act of love that she was trying to show me. And so it was a very like memorable experience that, although it's easy to, especially when I have some position or some power or some influence, as I did in that relationship with Vanna, being the temple president or whatever you want to call me, then it's very easy for me to indulge in the idea that my anger is justified, my anger is correct, my anger is going to be helpful for this person. This person needs me to get angry so that I can adjust them and help them become more Krishna conscious. In reality, though, I couldn't think of actually an example where my anger has ever really served me well. Especially like an impulsive expression of it. I've never experienced that a kind of impulsive gut reaction anger has ever done anything Krishna conscious for me. Usually it's gotten me into some trouble in which then I have to ask for forgiveness and then that helps my Krishna consciousness. But the immediate reaction of anger doesn't do much. So these were some of the thoughts that I had based on the few texts that we're reading here. And the cowherd men show us that relationship with Krishna is what can help us move past anger ultimately. No amount of mental adjustment or psychological deprogramming or reverse engineering of our previous experiences is going to be able to undo that tendency towards anger. It's only when we have a deep affection for Krishna and his devotees that we can actually, through the power of that emotion, overcome the overwhelming feeling of entitlement that is there in our conditioned anger. So I'll end there and now hope and open up to the devotees for your thoughts or examples on experiences with crazy people in Krishna consciousness and anger also, if anyone wants to share. Yes, Subal Prabhu.
We're thinking, thank you so much, Deva Madhava Prabhuji. We're thinking of a question in terms of anger that should try, in one sense, to understand the line, you know, because in some sense, discipline, when you have a responsibility and you're trying to establish certain discipline, sometimes you have to show, you know, that you're not pleased. So they have to, you have to express very strongly at times that, you know, anger in one sense. So sometimes we have that situation, for example, that example that you said with Vanna, Mataji, you're thinking, you know, in one sense you're very fond of her and you're upset, you know, because she may be doing something that you see that was irresponsible and makes you upset because it's affecting. So there's a line that one have to understand, that when is good or when is actually that is right, is correct, and when is crossing now into the part that is a bad emotion, that is causing, it doesn't cause anything good for anyone, not for you, not for the other person.
Yeah.
How do you recognize that?
Thank you for the question, Prabhu. I can share from my own experience that the importance, as you're discussing, as you're pointing out, of when we're in a position of responsibility and helping others to be accountable to something, especially in Krishna consciousness, then it can be useful to give them a sense of firmness or disappointment. You use that word, disappointment. And when I think of the word anger, I no longer think that it has a place in that conversation, because my feeling of disappointment is something very useful. My feeling of seeing that devotee in a better way than they see themselves is very useful. But when I think of anger, that's the part of the emotion, or that's the part of that relationship where, at least for me, when I use the word anger, I now reserve that word for the part of the relationship where I have some false ego in the game. Right? That I have this position, I have this power, I have this influence, you're mine, and you have to behave this way because you're mine, and I say that's that's how things that are mine have to be. And because I'm a conditioned soul and et cetera, then in all of my relationships where I have some power and influence, there's some tinge of that there. And my desire to get rid of that, part of my effort to do that is using the word anger to describe anything related to that. That sense of entitlement towards somebody else's behavior based on how I need them to behave so that I'll feel like I am the temple president or the bhakta leader or the big preacher or whatever the thing is that I need to feel so that I have a sense of self. That need to make somebody else be something so that we can feel like we are something comes from the fundamental lack of faith that we have in our own existence. Because I don't believe that I actually exist yet, because my existence, my sense of self is not rooted in a relationship with Krishna directly and purely, then there's an uncertainty about my own existence, and that's why I need others to let me know I exist by agreeing to be a part of relationships like my bhakta, or my wife, or my son, or etc. And so when they agree to be a part of those relationships, then it affirms my existence. And when they do something outside of what I say that relationship should look like, it threatens my existence. And because I'm not strong enough to admit my fear, then I get angry at them instead. Instead of admitting my fear of my own existence, I don't know that I exist yet. Instead, I get angry at them that how dare you behave this way because Prabhupada said, and Bhagavatam this, and GBC that. So that part of the emotion, my emotional experience, I'm trying to get rid of completely. And so I use the word anger to describe that. Maybe for you, the word anger doesn't mean only that. That sense of entitlement, which then comes out as this aggressive expression of your fearful nature. Maybe anger doesn't exclusively mean that for you. And then in that case, I would say it could be healthy to have a sense of anger towards somebody's not following through on their commitments from that place of knowing that they're sincere, they want to follow through on those commitments, they've asked you to help them do that, and you've accepted the responsibility to Prabhupada and the Parampara to be able to, and so you're putting your energy towards that. I think then, if that's what you mean by anger, it is healthy and useful.
Actually, you pointed out very, very nicely that is when the false ego gets involved in anything we do, any of the emotion, any of the whole diaspora of emotions that we have.
Yes.
When false ego is involved, then the whole thing is a mess.
Yes, it crumbles.
Yeah. I wanted to share one occasion that I observed this intense anger in a devotee.
Mm.
That it was, you know, it is one of those very famous traits of this great devotee. His Holiness Tamal Krishna Maharaj. And I literally never, the description of copper red eyes, I thought it was, you know, something.
Some metaphor or something.
Metaphoric, but actually, literally,
horrible.
Red eyes, you know, like burning like that. Was a situation that we were, His Holiness Gunagrahi Maharaj did his famous pizza parties back then. And we were serving our spiritual master, so it was His Holiness Tamal Krishna Maharaj, His Holiness Ramapad Swami, His Holiness Danodar Swami, and His Holiness Gunagrahi Maharaj. They were sitting there, and then the servants, you know, myself, another devotee, we were three of us serving all of them. So one of them was Raghunath. You know Raghunath, no?
Yes.
So Raghunath was enthusiastically bringing the pizzas just like out of the oven that Maharaj made. And as he's coming into the room, the sannyasis are sitting in the floor, he trips. And the pizza comes flying and lands, you know, in Radha Swami's lap. And my Guru Maharaj goes and look at the, I mean, actually everything went in slow
motion.
So you know, we're looking horrified at the pizza flying towards Rupa's
like something out of a movie.
And then Maharaj just look at the pizza, sort of like, you know, pick it up and put it in his plate and then, you know, cleans a little bit. And then we all horrified. And then Tamal Krishna Maharaj was looking at Rupa Swami's dhoti all messed up, and then literally you can see his eyes went red, and then he turns back, you know, towards Raghunath. I was like standing, you know, like he saw like the, you know, big question or something like that. And he just blasted him, like he just said with this booming voice, "You are not a devotee."
Hare Krishna.
And then that was it. Poor Raghunath just like in tears just disappear out of the scene, you know. Later, and then like something drop, and then go back and just start and say, what a great pizza and this and that, you know, nothing happens like that.
Very well. Hare Krishna.
Thank you for your very eloquent, nicely spoken class.
Gauranga.
It was really, really nice, especially the breakdown on anger. I'm not usually given to comments in Bhagavatam class because I've kind of beaten the tendency out of myself. But in this discussion, I felt to share something.
Yeah, please.
Because I have my own experience with this particular problem. I think anyone who has to be in a position of leadership, no matter how small that may be or how large it may be, has to face this thing.
Mm.
And surely Krishna puts them in that position mainly for their own purification rather than for the forwarding. In most cases, rather than for the forwarding of some, you know, of the movement, usually in the beginning it's for that devotee to see these anartas.
That's right.
And to be embarrassed and to want to let them go. At least that's my experience.
Yeah, the carrot of preaching and the plow of purification.
Yeah. And so I was thinking about this, and I found it interesting. Subal Prabhu brought up this point, and then you illustrated it nicely with your story from Tamal Krishna Maharaj, that sometimes we do see that there are devotees who they have some qualification or the adhikar to act in a way that most of us would not be able to act.
Hmm.
That I myself know I can't do. Hmm. It would be the ruination of my bhakti if I speak in such a way or if my physical actions are intense.
Hmm.
But there are some devotees who have some level of purity, they can do that because they're untouched by that. And then I was reminded of a story I was told by one friend. So my friend was walking down the street in France, and all of a sudden he saw a little kid a three-year-old run headlong into the street in front of a car. And the little kid made it across the street. The car stopped and he didn't get hit. But closely behind, just in tow, was his mother. And his mother ran up to him with a loud slap, you know, whacked him right in the back of the head. And my friend was thinking, if I hadn't seen that whole situation, I would have thought that this mother is a terrible person. How could she be given to such anger? How could she treat her child like that? You know, and obviously it's a three-year-old. I wasn't there, so probably wasn't her full force anyway. But the point was driven across. The child was crying. It was obviously traumatic for him.
Mm.
And my friend was thinking, if I hadn't seen that, I would think she was a horrible person. And I would think, I need to call the police. What is this? You know, child abuse.
Mm.
But because he had a perspective on the whole situation, he could understand that what he perceived or would have perceived was anger was actually coming from a place of deep, deep, deep love. Because like you were talking about earlier, the definition of anger being the little brother of lust is that ultimately it is stemming from a position of lust, like you so nicely elucidated. That this experience we generally have is coming from this desire to control, this fundamental lust. But then there's this other kind that higher devotees have access to, where in their corrections, like you were pointing out, because they're situated in love, they can't act from a platform of lust, because the two things are diametrically opposed. And so it's, yeah, just a thought. I find it very interesting how to reconcile this.
Yeah, I appreciate you pointing out that perspective gave him, you know, some may say it's still not very good to hit your kid, but at least you can understand, okay, you know, the mom was emotional, it was hard for her to watch that, you know, her child almost died, and now she's relieved, and it's like she wants to punish somehow, you know, like Mother Yashoda wants to punish Krishna somehow, so let me tie him up. So then you can have some perspective on the situation. That, to your question from Isubal Prabhu, that's also been my experience when I'm angry at someone. Once I get their perspective on the situation, my anger is almost never still present to the intensity and degree that it was before I heard their perspective. I may still feel disappointed, I may still feel cheated in a way, I may still feel like they can do better, etc., etc. But it's very, I can't think of one example where I didn't feel my anger abate, go away, basically, and be replaced by a different emotion like compassion or empathy or tolerance, etc. So, thanks, Josh. Anybody else would like to? Yes, thank you. You were supposed to give class, so at least please.
You know, the point you made about anger really actually indicating a necessity to affirm one's own existence in some way, I thought was a tremendous insight. And since you'd asked for examples of anger and dealing with it, I looked at perhaps one that was very prominent for me, and actually it was ongoing anger for a long time, and it had to do with being exposed to a person who factually stated to me a particular position that had been taken, and it was a completely morally reprehensible position. And I found myself feeling very angry at the thought even of the position that had been taken, like it was so abhorrent to me. And so I thought the best way for me to deal with it was to go and speak to the deities every day.
Very cool.
So indeed I did. I would actually speak my process. And the part that was of concern to me was, you know, how I could actually channel that anger in the correct way. So I thought, well, the best thing I can do is actually, at least because it had implications in the temple setting and the presence of that person in the community, that I perform the actions that would be the correct ones to allow for the proper course of action on the part of the community for that person, which meant that there was a punitive aspect involved. And but because of constantly staying in touch with the deities and speaking to the deities, and it took a long time, like 2 years for this to get resolved, because obviously the community has to move with something. And the community was in the opposite direction, turning a blind eye. So just continuing in like a very honest, careful, thoughtful way, thinking what's the best thing for this person, even though, you know, the position is so horrific, it actually came to the correct resolution, but it took a very long time. But I could not have done it were I not speaking to the deities
every day. Taking shelter in the Lord.
In terms of, you know, sharing that anger that it got aroused.
Do you feel that doing that brought you closer to them also?
No, not to the, to the deities, yes. Oh, well, the deities, they're always close. And I was just marveling at, and I've heard my spiritual master say that Krishna has his time. You know, how It's not that one stamps one's foot and says this must be taken care of right now.
I thought
it's very good for me to actually be speaking regularly to them, because then I'm also respecting the time in which things have to move and how they go. So it allowed me also to, you know, really detach more from the issue to some degree, although the anger took a long time to resolve because it was so abhorrent, the position taken. So, but anyway, had I not had the means to affirm my relationship with Krishna, I certainly might have been at the mercy of, just on a basic moral plane, feeling outraged.
Thank you. This is a beautiful example. Thank you for sharing.
It was just your nice point brought it to mind. Thank you.
Hare Krishna. Well, you lived the nice point. I want to share just something that I've come to recently myself also in going through an intense emotional experience. And the tendency might be, especially when it comes to anger, we suppress it rather than facing it or admitting it or bringing it to Krishna. We just kind of, at best, we ignore it and pretend as though it's not there, along with many other emotions that we feel or see as not good for Krishna consciousness or not good for my image or whatever it might be. What I've come to see, though, and your example illustrates really nicely, is that these kind of substandard, mundane emotions can have a real boost for our Krishna consciousness. They can be a real impetus for our relationship with Krishna, in the same way that a rocket can help the shuttle get up into the stratosphere and start to orbit the planet consistently. You guys have seen a shuttle taking off from Cape Canaveral in Florida. It usually has 3 or 4 rockets attached to it, right? But once the shuttle gets up into the outer atmosphere and starts orbiting the Earth, all those rockets are gone. What happened to them? Yeah, they got released along the way as the fuel inside burned up. But without those rockets, then the shuttle would still be sitting back on the ground. So there's this interesting dynamic that the rockets are needed, but only for some time. The fuel that they burn off, once it's gone, then the rockets break away and they propel the shuttle into that atmosphere. And so these substandard emotions, if we just let them go, if you light rocket fuel just out in the air, then it's going to create this horrendous combustion which can cause a lot of damage to a lot of people. But if you put rocket fuel inside of a rocket and attach it to a shuttle with the right kind of guidance and setup, then that can help the shuttle break out of the Earth's atmosphere and into outer space where it wants to be. So similarly, our emotions, be them anger or sadness or greed or lust or whatever they might be, there's a healthy way to allow those emotions to propel us towards Krishna. And when we do that, I've noticed, and it sounds like in your experience also it happened, the emotion burns away in the fire of Krishna consciousness, and simultaneously that emotion is a fuel that's propelling your Krishna consciousness. So I've noticed that in myself. Thank you for offering that. Anybody else? Jaini Taipubu, I saw you had a hand earlier. Did you want to?
I was just reading yesterday in Bhagavatam, Vidura was insulted by Duryodhana because his mother was a Sudrani.
Yeah.
And it is said, Prabhupada says, that his initial reaction was anger, and that he exercised his intelligence to mitigate that anger before acting.
Yes.
So I was thinking that the substance of your class really speaks to that, and I feel like a lot of the tools you gave in kind of understanding the nature of anger really helps in that, because it's like a fine line, because once one's angered, then the intelligence becomes bewildered. That's like the next step. So it's a very, it's a good opportunity to exercise Krishna consciousness. So I appreciate, I was just thinking about that.
Josh and I were having a conversation with a devotee last night, and that's what came up, was that every time this anger emotion is triggered, then you can, it's actually a blessing. You can take that as a signpost. Look here. Dig here. We want to find out the innermost depths of our conditioning so that we can pull those apart as much as possible. And when there's that trigger point of anger, it's a sign that if, rather than being worried about that person who's created that angry feeling inside of us, try to accept this premise that the problem lies within me, and dig at that sore spot and go deep and find out what is that fundamental insecurity that's causing me to react in the angry way. So it's actually a blessing. Josh.
Just one quick thing, just because you just made this point about the rocket, and then it reminded me immediately of a verse that I had been kind of chewing on, and I talked to another devotee about. He's actually a Sanskrit translator, and so he gave a lot of, he works with Madhavananda Prabhu Hari Parsha, and he gave a lot of clarity here. And the verse literally from the 11th canto, it summarizes exactly what you said.
Oh, really?
Perfect. It's coming from the Bhagavatam. So here's the English translation. O best of sadhus, whatsoever useless activities and their associated troubles, even acts such as running here and there out of fear, etc., if offered unto me, the Supreme Lord, with no desires for fruits, then they too are dharma. So the implication here is that all of these things, like you're saying, these rockets, these things that we would perceive as mundane, if we find a way to use them to accentuate our worship of the Supreme, and that may be feeling ashamed about them and therefore wanting to get rid of them, but doing that in a way that I'm praying to Krishna about it,
yes,
then they become, they also become dharma. And particularly dharma here means paradharma, means bhakti.
Hey, Bo.
So it's right in the 11th canto, what you're saying. Oh. It's very nice.
Thanks for that, Praman.
Yeah, yeah.
Sundari, did you have something? No? Okay. Anyone else? Comments, questions? Okay, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Ramcharaj Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Shri Kishore Kishore ji ki jai. Samaveda Bhaktivinoda ki jai. Gaura Premanandi.